You're listening to Drukama Radio. My name is Kieran, and it's a pleasure to be co-hosting the show today. It's a privilege to have Daishi joining us, expounding on the deeper mysteries of reincarnation and its connection to the karmic imprint. Welcome, Daishi, and thank you for offering up your valuable time to dive deep into this intriguing subject.
Well, you built it up. Too much. I hope that I can make it that exciting. Thank you for having me. Let's dive into it.
Absolutely. So, short and to the point, what is karma?
I guess the way to look at karma is simply just cause and effect. It really is just a way that we motion toward the reactionary body-mind. And every time we take action, whether it's energetic, mental, emotive, physical, through speech, etc., it sort of puts a stamp on the energies that bind us into this reality and weaves kind of a web that we live in constantly by that cause and reaction. So the more that we're creating causes, the more that we're binding ourselves in their effects. And so karma is the boomerang or the web or the suture or the thread that binds us down into this reality so that we're stuck in death and rebirth and that cycle of reincarnation.
Where do these karmic imprints come from and what causes them?
The way that we can look at that, I think, is if we step back first and we'll look at the fact that most people are operating from an unconscious perspective. And when I say unconscious, I don't mean that they're not aware of what they're doing, because most people say, hey, that's not fair, I'm aware. I get that. What I'm saying is unconscious to the system and the process by which they're acting. And so I think as we delve deeper into our own process and we become more conscious of the process, we can see that the cause actually happens probably way back further than we would know in a normal state. So what I mean by that is you may say, well, I'm feeling angry because someone said something to me that I found offensive. What we're really not understanding, I think, behind that is that there are many causes or a bigger cause that happens way before the reaction of the emotions and the mental, intellectual correspondence with anger and the offensive remark. So my point there is those reactions, so if somebody insults us, for example, those reactions that we put out are mostly robotic. They're mostly pre-programmed, predestined, and they're influenced by society, influenced by our upbringing, influenced by our family, and so on. So as the mind-body gains data as it grows up and gets older and is influenced by its surroundings and it gains data, that data imprints on us all kinds of synaptic responses that kind of flow out of us automatically. You know, the way that we laugh at a joke or the way that we respond negatively to certain foods or the way that we respond negatively to offensive remarks by other people and defending ourselves and the way that we sort of act in a day-to-day, moment-by-moment way is mostly robotic and it's mostly unconscious. We have the idea that we're doing this in free will, but the truth is really most of that is just a reactionary impulses from societal influences. And so basically, if we look at the mind as a bunch of aggregate kind of compartments, we can see that there's an intellectual side, there's a memory side, there is an identity side, an egoic side or a boundary side, there's the consciousness or the awareness itself, the cognition. So there are all these departments that operate in and of themselves and also kind of together in concert that seem to make up a person. There seems to be an identity there when really it's not such. There is no identity in that. It just seems to be an identity. So all of these different compartments of the mind, they're all firing off in separate kind of processes. And when the awareness watches this, by the time it sees it all, based on its conscious level of acuity, it thinks that it's the self doing things through free will, arbitrarily, unconsciously, and so on. But the truth of the matter is most of that stuff is happening more robotically than we want to admit or that we really can see. So I think the first thing to see is that we want to break free from that unconsciousness. We want to understand the process better. We want to see how we work and how this selfing mechanism functions inside. And then secondly, we can begin to understand, I think, how karma plays its part in that. And every time we react unconsciously, we embed deeper into that karmic weaving. And we want to stop that from happening, essentially. The idea of the spiritual path, or one part of it at least, is to back away from that karmic imprint so that we can begin to make distance and start to rise into a new level or new dimension of life.
How would you define physical karma?
Physical karma comes in two forms. I guess we can say like two different ways that we get physical karma. One is through our parents, and they give us some of their karma. And that's why family lineages carry on some karmic imprints. We pass that on as well, unless we can overcome it through our karmic cleansing or karmic purification. And then there's our own karma that we bring back into the new body we settle in. And if we believe in reincarnation, and the sages of the past have told us in many, many traditions that this is the way that they believe life is. If we keep cycling back into new bodies, we carry with us a sort of residue, and that karmic stamp then enters that new vessel. So we come into the new vessel, we adopt the karmas that the parents and the entire family lineage brings to us, and then we bring our own as well. And so we're faced with both problems. If, in fact, we do have bad karma, negative karma from the family, and negative karma from our own experiences that we haven't cleaned up, that can cause some real problems physically. So that's kind of how we look at the physical karma side.
I guess that would lead us into the need to describe what emotional or psychic karma is. Can you speak to that?
Our emotions are basically energy that is being felt by the cognition, although no one really knows where emotions are generated from. They're sort of the phantom ghost of the experience, because the neuroscientists really are still trying to figure out where emotions are, along with awareness, right? The two of a few phantom operations that we're not sure where they're actually located. But emotions are an energy, and we just happen to label them so that we can talk about them. We gave them names, you know, like this particular energy we call angry, or this energy we call aggressive, or this energy we call anxious, or this energy we call depressed, this energy we call bliss, and so on. They're all just energy signatures that are in the body. They shake and move us, they vibrate, and they give us some type of sensation. Sometimes those are physical. Sometimes we can feel them, you know, in our gut. Sometimes we can feel them in our heart. You know, when there's a panic, sometimes you grab your heart. Or sadness, you grab your heart. And when there's anxiety, you grab your tummy. So there's all these areas in the body that subsequently can be felt. But really, emotions aren't necessarily felt anywhere but through the awareness's kind of agreement that, hey, this vibration is flowing all around and I'm calling it X. And so those karmas come from a higher plane, a higher dimension of reality. And those karmas are carried on with us, just like the physical karma. It's carried on as we're born again, stamped into our new vessel. But these are the energies that we didn't, again, just like physicality, we didn't deal with, we are not conscious of, and we haven't accepted. And so normally all the aversions, you know, the things we push away to the corner, I don't want to face this, I don't want to deal with this, and most of that's unconscious, all of that stuff we push away just keeps following us. It won't ever be gone from us until we've actually faced it, understood it, unified with it, and accepted it. And once that happens, the karma sort of washes away because it doesn't serve a purpose anymore. It served its purpose. It's caused us to have some wakefulness, and we can move on.
I guess that leaves mental karma. Is it possible to speak to that?
Mental fabrications, again, we can feel that they don't have as much weight, right? So when we go down this line of pure energy, and we can kind of say it in 4 degrees, pure energy, mental energy, emotional energy, and then physical energy. Of course, the physical energy we feel the most. That's when the bones hurt. We have digestive problems and all these other issues come up. And those are serious. Those are heavy. We feel them. Emotional energy is still very thick. It's heavy. We can feel it. Mental energy becomes to be a little less weighty. So we can say that we have mental afflictions, and they can be very haunting and very problematic, but they're still not as heavy as an emotional energy. The thought of losing someone without the emotion of losing them, in other words, if you just thought about it arbitrarily and there was no emotional attachment, isn't so much of a problem. But as soon as there's an emotional connection to that thought, then it becomes heavy, hurtful, and it drags us down. So really, the mental fabrications and the conceptualizations of the mind generate that strong emotional pull, and then that ties them together and drags us into a problem potentially. So again, on the path, we want to move away from fabrications of the mind, the undulations of the mind, all the mental iterations, and learn to make some space there so that we don't let the match start the forest fire in the first place, and we kind of get away from the beginnings, which are the mental karmas that come up on and on again until we face them just like we face the others.
It would seem that most people come into each incarnation with a natural talent, or at least a latent talent, sometimes more. Is this a result of past karmic imprinting?
Absolutely. We carry everything forward. And in the same way negative karma gets carried forward, our positive attributes get carried forward as well, our merits. And that can be that in a past life, maybe you were, you know, very loving person, or you tried to be, you really aspired to be a more thoughtful person, a more considerate person. And when you moved on to the next incarnation, your ability to really connect with others was strong and profound, more so than the people around you. So you found yourself being, in some cases, pushed away from groups and meetings and connections with others because the connection to them and their issues hurt you as well. And in that kind of altruistic, empathetic scenario, it was difficult for someone with this condition or this merit. I'm using merit, but I'm poisoning it a little bit. But when they have this problem, they sometimes want to get away and they don't want to be around because it's difficult to deal with the feelings of others, especially if the feelings in the other people are negative. And in like way, we can feel the positivity of people as well. And also, if we're very empathetic in that same analogy, our emotional strength can also lend to them and uplift them. So there's some benefit there that maybe other ordinary people are not carrying as a karmic or merited gift. Just one example of many we could make. That also gets carried over. So different people on the path have different tendencies. They have different abilities, different ways of using their merits and experiencing their merits. And a lot of people don't even know they have them until they get on the path and start to cultivate these things a little bit, awaken themselves consciously a little bit, and then start to explore and then realize, wow, I've just awoken a lot of latent kind of things that were sitting around in my system. And now they're acute and intense and all these things. And that happens quite a bit.
In regards to karma, what happens when we die? And is this related to the idea of the weighing of the heart against a feather in the Hall of Mart?
It's a great story because that essentially lets you know that the things that have pulled you down, that you've allowed to anchor you into this world, are going to cause your heart some heaviness. And that really is the way for you to test yourself to see if you're ready to move on. Have you been able to overcome these things? Have you been able to see the heaviness around you and turn that into something acceptable and beautiful and transmuted it and faced it? And if you've done those things pretty well, then by the time that you carry on, based on your karma and your merit, you would basically ascend to another plane that's similar to your attributes. So you'd be placed in a realm or a dimension, as we're told, that would be a connection for you in terms of your attributes, like other attributes would be there, and they would be able to interact with you until the merit ran out, until you burned your karma out, that good karma got burnt, and then we're told you would descend down and come back into another vessel and try again. And you would continue this process as your consciousness is carried from body to body until you've really learned how to take the weighty, heavy energy of that lower animal soul and understood how to transmute it and transmigrate it up into something higher, more beautiful, and more efficient, more effective for the whole group. And that's truly how we look at the reincarnation, the death and rebirth cycle, is that you're just going through this process. And inevitably, as you go through it enough, you would eventually liberate from it. You would graduate from it. You wouldn't need to come back here or into any of the realms in the structure. You would move on completely to an entirely new structure. On the path, the spiritual path, we want to get that done as fast as possible. So we'll see that as being the absolute highest evolutionary process for mankind. And we say, okay, this is what we're here for. This is the purpose of life. So let's just attend to this quickly. Let's just get into this and get it done as fast as possible. And that's really where you have someone who wakes up in the world and says, okay, I've kind of had enough of this place. I don't really see the purpose here. Then we introduce them to the path, move them along quickly through this path, and we sort of scrub away karma, build up merit, and eventually realize until they liberate out of the system entirely because they become clear. And basically liberation, again, just means no ignorance.
Speaking to the cycles of rebirth, what would be the relationship between karma and each rebirth?
That's a tough question because that would get into the various realms that someone would then go up to, how long they'd stay in that Bardo area, that sort of in between, and what level of consciousness they had when they passed on. So for some people, they're conscious enough to experience the upper realms after death and then understand that they need to take another rebirth and take that rebirth consciously. So literally picking or choosing where they're going to end up in their next life and then using that life for the betterment of their path and for helping and having compassion toward others and potentially helping others. And then there's the majority of the people who are just unconscious. When they pass away, they see the fabrications of their karma and then chase down another womb because the womb is something that feels very comfortable to the soul. We all want to be back in mother's belly. There is absolute protection and comfort there. We're totally protected in that space. So that space feels fantastic to a soul once it's departed from the body, especially if it's unconscious. So it usually goes back into a womb and then settles back and is born again. And that karma that carries with them is the reason why brothers and sisters and moms and dads and siblings, cousins, and so on are all so different. You know, we don't see one family that has all the same attributes. You always have a black sheep. So where did that guy come from? So those absolutely bizarre variances in siblings and family structure are because of our karmic differences. And they make up who we are because they're imprinting and affecting us unconsciously constantly as we live in this world.
What would be considered the most effective way to remove these karmic imprints? And how does removing these karmic imprints help us reach realization and liberation?
Of course, you know, if I were on the path and I heard somebody tell me that karma is the only issue we have, I would immediately ask, just like you did, tell me how to remove it, right? Tell me the most effective way to get rid of it. I'll do it all day. So that's a very powerful question, but I'm going to tell it to you in a way that's probably not going to be very satisfactory. There are ways to get to karma. There are many ways to get to your karma and eliminate karma. And all of the applications and methods that have to do with karma alleviation are all based on conscious awareness. I mean, essentially, it comes down to one thing: being clear toward the rhythms, the cycles that come to you in terms of left and right polarities. So you have negative events and positive events. And as they come into your life, being conscious and accepting them for what they are is a very quick way of relieving yourself from karmas. Now, you can say there are other ways. We can get up into the central column, into the main energy channel of the body, and we can just burn karmas away without even dealing with rhythms that come up in our lives. There are other ways to get to karmas as well, for sure. However, facing them directly is a very fast and very effective way. Now, the problem with that, and the reason why I said it's not going to be a very satisfactory answer, is because we have to first build a foundation of consciousness. Our will, our ability to single-pointed focus on our object of contemplation must be strong first. And also, our intention must be in there. We must understand what intention is. So there are some parts that have to be put together before we can just arbitrarily go out and start to really move karma. And so I would suggest to anyone who's interested in that to visit us, and we'd be happy to show you not only the foundational phases, but also the phases in removing the karma and helping you get along that path in a way that makes more sense than just a soundbite here on the show.
There are many skeptics out there stating that there's no real proof of reincarnation. So how do we know that reincarnation actually happens? Has there been any proof of this, or should one simply take it on faith based on the teachings of the masters? And is there a way that we can intuitively understand rebirth, and how does this manifest in our lives as actual signs?
Big questions again. So let me start with the first one. I would say the easiest way to understand without faith the cycle of rebirth, or whether that's a fact or not, is to look at two things. One thing is that historically, throughout the generations going back thousands of years, reincarnation has been taught, understood, and talked about in philosophies across the world in hundreds of traditions and mystical traditions and cultures. So we can look at the data there and say, okay, well, enough people throughout time who have done a lot of meditation, a lot of seeking, have come to the same conclusions as they penetrate up into the upper worlds, that we continually fall back into this reincarnation state. So that's one thing. We can look at that. We really want to go more on our own experience, which I love to do because I don't believe in faith so much as I believe in direct experience. I would say that there's a greater chance that we're going to die and come back to a place like this and be around billions of other souls simply because we've already done it once. In other words, the proof is here. We've already done that. So the chance of it happening again is much greater than the chance of us dissolving into nothing, which has never happened. So my point is, if we're going to pick the two, we die and we become nothing, or we die and we come back here, at least I have some proof that this place already exists and that it's already happened once before. So just in that, I don't have to have too much faith to say that, hey, it already happened. It's probably going to happen again. Rather than saying we've only hit it once and it was lucky and we're going to go fade to nothing, which has not ever happened. At least no one can prove it has. So in that, I would say that we have a better chance of having a reincarnation process than anything else, which is the dissolution into nothingness. So based on those two things, that we have historical data going back from hundreds of different traditions all across the world, and we've already experienced a birth, and we've already come to a world where we're surrounded by others who don't really know how they got here. So it seems that it's happened. So those two things point to probably that reincarnation, based on all the other evidence, is the best chance we've got at this point. So there's that. And then third, I would say, as a sidebar to all of that, when you sit down and go deep enough and recreate the death process within, and this is just a matter of going through a certain kind of drawing in of the energy winds of the body, and you go through that death cycle, you can see through that process that there is an actual method by which we can attain to the higher realms and come back into this life, just like a reincarnation process, very similar. And you can kind of see that happen. So you can have direct experience of it as well. So that answers that question as best as I can. Okay, again, that's still going to be somewhat based on faith. And unfortunately, that's what we have until you start the path and get down deep enough to experience it for yourself. And on the other side, you asked me if there's scientific proof. Is that what it was?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that science has the ability yet, although we hear more and more physicists talking about different dimensions now. A lot of very well-known physicists have come out and said that there's different dimensions. We believe that there may be 10 or 13 or 9 and so on. So they're actually gone to the point where different dimensions exist. We just don't have the perceptive tools to move into them. I would argue we do. They're atrophied and we have to build them up. However, I would suggest that because science is now looking toward the fact that there are other dimensions of reality that we're not aware of, that opens the idea that there could be all kinds of possibilities for our consciousness to move from this state into another state at death. So consciousness doesn't die, it just moves to another area of reality. And so that could be one of the ways that science is starting to prove that consciousness is something that doesn't die, it just floats back into other states of form or matter or whatever. The other thing I would say is that there have been tens of thousands of recorded near-death experiences. And I know the argument from an atheistic point is that's just the brain shutting down and it does this every time we die. However, I would argue this. If these tens of thousands of cases of near-death experiences, which are all seeing the same kinds of phenomenon, are all just the brain putting on a show as it dies, I would say, who is it putting on the show for exactly? Itself or for an aware soul, right? So if the body is going to die and it knows it's going to die, it doesn't need to put a show on for itself. It's not duping itself. It's not kidding itself. But it may be trying to put on a show for something else residing within it. And the question then becomes, why would it put on a show for that thing if it's going to become not? What would be the point in that? There would be no reason for it to do that. So I think the idea that the brain is just shutting down and some phenomenon still happening and there's a conscious observer seeing that is quite silly. The brain wouldn't need to expend that energy. It would know that, hey, we're dead. No reason for me to put on fireworks. It's over. It would simply just shut off. But instead, it seems that the cognition is experiencing something otherworldly. It's moving from this base reality to another one. And I think that makes way more sense than the idea that, again, the brain's just doing some kind of show for some visitor that happens to be inside the brain body.
Would you consider there to be any value in remembering past incarnations?
Well, there is value because it helps to secure and solidify our knowing about reincarnation. So as you get into the path and you get deeply embedded into the stream state or the spiritual state, where we have sort of turned on some type of organic inner sense, these ideas and remembrances of past lives come to the practitioners. They start to have these strange dreams or strange meditative states where they're seeing themselves or remembering visions of other times that they didn't experience in this life. I think that the only benefit that that has is it reinforces the whole idea that it looks like I am returning to the same place over and over again. I'm somehow just not remembering it, or I'm not holding consciousness enough to recall it as I come back. And so those are showing me that I have been other places that I haven't necessarily experienced in this life. And because of that, it allows me and it pushes me forward further on the path. And I think anything that pushes us forward on the path is very beneficial. So in that way, it's beneficial. But as far as the data goes, I don't see any reason why that's important. Whatever happened, happened. It's done. There's no way to reach back to it. And what's really important is right now and where we are now in terms of our temporal self, our transient self, and how we're dealing with that.
When masters speak of enlightenment and liberation, what is it that they mean exactly?
I think what they're talking about is the utter removal, again, of ignorance. And I think ignorance is in all of us. We're all ignorant to what's going on around us, to how we operate, to the energies of the body. We're ignorant to our unconscious process. And so I think enlightenment means that we have become knowledgeable about the areas that were concealed or that we were ignorant of prior. And that doesn't sound too exciting, but believe me, I think the point is very valuable in that when we become aware and knowledgeable about ourselves and how we process, we can dictate how we perceive reality rather than reality dictating how we perceive it. So we get to change hands. We get to become an active participant in reality rather than a reactive participant in reality. And the reactive participant in reality suffers greatly because the soul doesn't like to be chained down and commanded and told what to do. It wants to be boundless and free. It's infinite by nature. So when we're trapped in this sort of control box, the soul just doesn't like that. And it's very obvious. It's the reason we look for so much freedom. And the spiritual path is, in fact, the keys into which we get freedom because we learn about ourselves through that process. That's vital. And today in our world, it's absolutely critical because we've lost our connection to each other. We've lost our way of communicating and allowing people to have their own objective opinions and loving them for it. And we've lost our ability to be open and receive people the right way. And because of this, we're seeing more division around us constantly. And this division isn't going to end well. In no way does more division ever end well for anybody involved. It doesn't. We have to learn how to come together. We have to learn how to appreciate each other. We have to learn how to see the beauty in our differences. You know, I always make the joke, if the whole world were just a bunch of me's, I would have killed myself a long time ago of boredom. It has to be everybody else. It needs to be everyone else's exciting adventures and sharing what we've experienced with each other, our creativity. That's what it has to be about. We have to learn to love that, learn to be embedded in that.
Beautiful. I guess that about wraps it up for today. Thank you again, Daishi. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate it also. I know you have a lot going on, and I appreciate you spending time doing this. So I thank you for that.
Thank you once again for joining us, dear listeners, here at Drukhama Radio. If you guys have any questions or comments related to the topic of this show, please send us an email. The address is radio@drukama.com. That's drukama.com. We look forward to having you present next week for another enlightening episode.